So we left off. I didn't make a mark in my Bible.
I had it starting chapter 21.
Chapter 21. Well, I did put 20 to 21. I wasn't sure where we stopped, so I put it 20 to 21.
When I left last time, we were going to start 21, but I couldn't remember if I missed one or not.
Nope, I don't. Well, if you did, I did. So.
Okay, I think since two of you believe it, we start with 21, that we'll start with 21.
In the mouth of two or three witnesses,
Yeah.
it shall be established.
All right, so Bill, if you would please read chapters 21, 1 to 9.
1 to 9. Got it. Okay. And this is from the Free Bible Version. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. The first heaven and the first earth had disappeared, and the sea no longer existed. I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, descending from God out of heaven, prepared like a bride, made beautiful for her husband. I heard a loud voice from the throne say, "Now God's home is with human beings, and he will live with them. They will be his people. God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death will never happen again. There will be no mourning or crying or pain ever again, for the former world no longer exists." The one who sits on the throne said, "I am making everything new." He told me, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." And then he said to me, "Everything's done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To anyone who is thirsty, I will give the free gift of water from the spring of the water of life. Those who are victorious will inherit all these things, and I will be their God, and they shall be my children. But anyone who is a coward, who doesn't trust me, who does disgusting things, who is a murderer, who is sexually immoral, who practices witchcraft, who worships idols, who tells lies, their chosen place is in the lake of fire the lake that burns with fire and sulfur. This is the second death." One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls containing the seven last plagues came and spoke to me. He said, "Come with me. I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife." That was through verse 9.
Yeah, I think that's enough. So, well, this is one of my favorite verses in Revelation. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "See, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them. They shall be his peoples. And God himself will be with them. And he will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death." And the reason I love that is that to me, that is what God is after from the beginning to the end, to be with his people. And I just love that as his motive, his the thing that is leading him through all of this, going through all of this, is because he wants to be with us. He hates the separation.
Genesis restored. I mean, we're
Yeah.
talking new creation, so yeah.
Yes. Yes. But we're a new creation in a different way. We're not having, unless we're raised from the dead, we're not a new creation. We're alive and going through this with him, which I think is a high honor.
And so, I mean, I come back to the promise, wiping away the tear, death will never happen again. no mourning, crying, or pain. The former world no longer exists. I grew up, and perhaps it wasn't intended, but it's the way my little child brain worked, that God would create or recreate in a way that prohibited, freedom from existing, but prohibited tears or death, as opposed to a unending intentional design that is so settled into the truth about God revealed in the incarnate Christ that they cannot be shaken away from that reality, that the grand rebellion that had occurred, that brought death, that brought mourning, that brought tears. It's in freedom that it never happens again. I guess I'm drawing that contrast from how I was in my thinking long ago and where my thinking is now. And I don't know if there's more to it or if that's just a common reading.
I think there are various facets to this. I think your facet is very, very good. The facet I think of is he's going to there's no longer going to be any need for tears. It's just not going to be needed. But you notice that he doesn't take away all tears from our eyes or wipe away all tears from our eyes as long as the end of the millennium is on and the wicked are there. Because there will be many tears shed. And that's why I think he's saying, I will wipe away all tears from their eyes. Because all the tears we shed over those we love that aren't going to be in heaven is going to be. That's resolved with the final destruction of the wicked and the new heaven and the new heaven and the new earth. You have to have the new heaven and new earth. It can't be just the final destruction. It's the whole package.
I guess I don't see it that way. Partly because when you read, you have to read linearly because you can't read two things at the same time. And so the way that Revelation is laid out is, and I think Tonstadt sort of brings this out a little bit. So you're dealing with two sides of a war. And just like in a movie, you're going to have a section of the movie showing what's going on with this person. And then they'll cut to another person and then show what they're doing maybe at the same time. But you watched it at two different times. And in your head, you realize, okay, while this person's doing that, that person's doing that, but you can't watch them simultaneously. So you have to watch them sequentially, but you know that they overlap. I think the same thing as in Revelation is that it keeps switching back and forth between the dark side, the light side, the dark side, the light side, but that doesn't mean they're necessarily sequential. It doesn't mean they're linear. So we just read 19, where, you know, the whole collapse of Babylon, and well, that was 18. And then 19 is like the final dissolution. And now it flips over to say, okay, let's see what's going on from the other perspective, but not necessarily after what happened in 19, it could be overlaid, some of it. And according to how Ellen White writes it, it seems even more clear that it's overlaid because she talks about the holy city coming down before the lake of fire, before the attack on the city.
Right. That's right. It does come down before the lake of fire.
And so this is, okay, from God's people's perspective, this is the rest of the story, but it overlays the last chapter. So wiping tears from their eyes, I don't know why, but a lot of people have seemed to conclude that that means there's even a popular song years ago, I know in heaven you're not supposed to cry. That just scandalizes me. I think the whole point of that phrase is God is a God of comfort. And when you're crying, he himself personally is going to be there wiping the tears from your eyes, not because you're not supposed to cry, but because he's resonating with you. He's probably crying with you, but he wants to wipe the tears from your eyes like a good mother. And I think the emphasis here is on compassion and identification with your sadness, not trying to remove the sadness, but identifying with you and joining you in it.
So I agree. And I think the first, what I have is paragraph 1 through 4, spans a vast amount of time. In contrast, and I agree that in contrast to the previous couple chapters, John or the Revelator is giving us a picture of a new chapter in a sense and saying, okay, now this, but it's a thread back to, because we see the kingdom come in Revelation prior to the lake of fire, and we don't know how long it's there. Big 1500 whatever cube. But then I will say that it's something Gene said for me, and this resonates, is that the millennium is the time we have to come to terms with why somebody isn't there. And I think that there is mourning, there is crying, and there is a sense of pain, and God is our comforter, wiping that away with us. And then in the same paragraph that I have, there will be, now we're future looking, no more mourning, crying, or pain, well, or death for that matter, because that is no longer existing. So there is a transition. It's not that we're not supposed to cry.
Right.
It's that there's no need for it.
The cause is.
That's what I was trying to get at.
Yeah. Right.
That's true. I'm just saying that a lot of, especially the wiping away the tears, I view it less as there's no more reason to cry, as, I mean, the most effective way to calm a crying child is not to say, stop crying. You know, it's to sit down and, I mean, a good mother is going to sit down and wipe the tears out of her eyes and say, oh, I'm so sorry you feel that way. And literally wiping tears out of somebody's eyes is one of the most amazing signs of affection. One of the most intimate signs of affection. It's bonding. And for me, that's the most important part of that phrase, is that God wants to bond with us in that pain. And that's how you recover from
it. Yeah, I think we need to see this in the context of comfort.
Yeah.
But that does not exclude that the first things have passed away.
That's true. And this, I see this part of this chapter anyway, as a summary statement. Like there's a number of other places where it's a summary statement that's expanded on either before or after it. So this is saying, okay, this and this and this and this and this are all going to happen during this time period.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of on the other side of that, but it's still summarizing, because, you know, there'll be no more death. We already said in the last chapter that death and Hades are thrown in the lake of fire.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's reiterating that death is no more. So it's almost redundant. Or just saying it in a different way.
Well, I guess for me, the grounding aspect is remembering that before Earth, there was rebellion. And Earth, it seems to me from the biblical narrative, that we were intended to be the answer to all the charges against God.
Right.
And the confusion sowed. And we didn't help by failing.
Mm-hmm.
That just set in motion other things God would do. And this is saying that great controversy, the cosmic conflict, this universal struggle, this is the light story, the light, the glow, the candle lit, saying, okay, let's have some good news, because I just had several chapters of bad news.
Right, yeah.
And one of those things, Bill, is in the statement in Genesis 2, in the day you eat of it, you will surely die. Not anymore.
Correct.
That whole question about sin leading to death has been answered at the cross. And all the ramifications from it have been settled. Everything is settled. And so that you shall surely die will never happen again.
If I apply the principle that I start with in verse 1 of the book and back away from literalizing the heavens and the earth, which is very easy to literalize, and say, what from the context of the Great War, what might this say? Immediately, like you pointed out, when this earth is created, the war was already full blown.
Yes.
In the heavens.
Yeah.
Which involved a lot of deceived or partially deceived angels, I believe, that has been dealt with for untold amounts of time. That's all been transpiring parallel to what's been going on this earth, just a lot older. So when it says new heavens, for me, that says, okay, this thing is completely resolved among all the heavenly beings. It wasn't always resolved, but now it is. A new earth, okay, yes, the war transitioned to earth. At this point, now that is how resolved. Everybody has made up their mind, made up their choices, gone their different directions. It's over. That's why I think it's emphasizing heavens. It's talking about the beings in heavens, not necessarily physically. And it's talking about the earth, again, not physically, but because the war involved humans who were supposed to cut this whole thing short and actually ended up extending it. But it's over now.
Mm-hmm.
I would take that as a symbolical application. And when you've milked that as much as you can, and which is what I've done with everything in Revelation, try to get as much as I can out of the symbol, and then, and only then, say, okay, it could additionally involve literal.
Mm-hmm.
Because the literal is really a symptom or a reflection of the spiritual. So our physical world, in a great degree, reflects the sin problem in the spiritual realm. So the reflection is going to change when the origin changes.
I'm curious, looking at verse 5, he says, see, I am making all things new. And then he says, after he says these words are trustworthy and true, he says, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. What significance does the Alpha, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, have to you? I'm throwing this out to anyone.
I have to admit, as I read that, the first question I had was, what does it say in the original? Because the Alpha and the Omega, isn't that the words for beginning and end, and then it's repeated?
No. Alpha is the alpha letter of the Greek alphabet. The Omega is the final letter of the Greek alphabet.
So I'm the first, and I'm the last, I'm the beginning, exactly. And I'm the end.
Exactly. He's saying it in several ways. Make it when Jesus does that, he's making it very definitive and very, this is you've got to hear this. This is important. I finalized it. Everything's done.
Well, so this is, I think, to address the question, perhaps rather than just answer it, right? I'm going to try and address it, is the idea that God is life. There is no darkness or death in him. Those who love darkness have chosen death. Those who love light, or who were willing to come into the light, have life. So he's this beginning and completeness. Maybe rather than beginning and end, God is complete. And our completeness create...
All-inclusive.
Yes, all-inclusive. Our completeness is embodied.
I think that's very fair and very helpful.
Here's another application. Alpha and Omega have to do with letters. Words are made up of letters, right? He is the Word.
Yes.
So he's saying, I take full responsibility for every word that you can possibly make out of the alphabet. I take ownership of it. I take responsibility for the whole thing. And I will resolve it. So there are no words that aren't not made up of letters. They don't exist. So when he says, I am A to Z, he zipped up the whole thing. And he said, I'll take full responsibility for every word everywhere of any kind, and I will deal with it, and I will resolve it. I will bring it to a conclusion. And then the beginning and the end is just at a different venue. And that reminds me that in Revelation 12, it was Michael who is first mentioned as waging war. And then it says the dragon fought back with his angels. I believe Michael is the one, he didn't cause the war, but he's the first one to stand up and call him out and say this is not right publicly, because it didn't do any good to do it privately. And he was the first one to call him out. And when you call someone out in high leadership, they either repent or they fight. So he fought back, making it appear that Michael starting the war, but Michael is simply speaking the truth that was undermining, you know, against the lies that were undermining God's reputation. And that's what brought the war out into the open. And then when the devil fought back, it turned into a full-fledged two-sided war.
There's an interesting statement by Ellen White in, I think it is Story of Redemption, where she has Satan declaring war on God.
And I think that was his response to Michael speaking the truth.
Yeah, that was, but it saying that Michael did the war against Satan. He started it. He started it by saying the truth, but not by fighting.
Right, right. I agree.
And I think we need to make that difference clear.
I agree. But it does say in Revelation 12 that Michael and his angels warred against the dragon, and the dragon fought back. But the war, the very word war there, is polemics. It's not aggressive fighting. It's polemics. It's about words.
Right. I think it was a logomachy, which is a war of words.
Yeah.
Claims and counterclaims.
Claims and counterclaims and charges and probably not countercharges.
Right.
Charges.
So that would be the beginning. That's the beginning of the war. And Michael was there at the beginning of the war.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And now at the end of the war, it's resolved again with a full revelation of the truth about God, which the Lamb is God's Christ.
Words made Word made incarnate.
Yes. So Michael was God's Christ from the very beginning because he was standing up for God's reputation.
Well, he's the Word because he is the story of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason word is used there is because you're now moving to a different time period. Instead of in Hebrew thinking, you're now in Greek thought. And logos, which was the word for word, was extremely important in Greek thought. So the Gentile listeners to the book of Revelation would fully grasp something perhaps we don't, in terms of what that word signified. And I'm not even clear on it. When I was 13, I was trying to read a book on that had a large treatment of logos and what it meant for Jesus to be logos. And it was so steep and so heavy, I gave up reading it because I couldn't make sense of it. But I did get the impression that logos was a very important Greek word to Western culture.
And I think compellingly, that same word with all that weight added to it, logos, is the word in Matthew 18 translated, the king wanted to settle accounts. The word translated accounts is logos.
So if he is the word, he is the settler of all accounts.
Right. And obviously the whole thing is about debts, right? So you have to say what kind of debt is created with words.
The ability to have trust.
Yeah. Offenses are caused by words. And the king wants to resolve everything that is coming between, that's disrupting the relationship that they had. And he wants to settle it. He wants to reconcile. He wants to resolve it. That was his motive. And when we understand that the word logos is the issue at the heart of it, then you understand the nature of this debt between this man and the king. And I find it even more compelling that if you calculate according to their estimation of the size of his debt equals 150,000 years of wages. I can't help but wonder if Jesus was not telling the story of Lucifer and that the debt had been going for 150,000 years, long before the earth was created, from our perspective. Just speculation, but I sometimes don't think he just picks a number out of the hat.
It's interesting that it's from something that's metaphorically intellectual. Jesus switches immediately to the thirsty, I will give water as a gift from the spring of the water of life. Surely everybody.
He calls himself the water of life too, though.
Yeah. Surely everybody who is in this scene are longing to know better who God is, because there'll be lots of people translated or taken to heaven who don't have a full knowledge of who God is.
Well, nobody is.
I know that, but I mean, they don't have the...
Right. They have almost none.
Yeah, they have almost none. And so that's what he's going to do next. We're going to give you vast drinks of this water of life that is about me and who I am and what kind of a God I am.
which again, if this is an overlay, that begins in the millennium, but does not stop at the end of the millennium.
Exactly. Well, to those who are still thirsty, you could say.
Right.
And all who trust him are going to be thirsty.
I think even those of us who have been out through the millennium are going to be very thirsty, especially right. In the wake of having seen this whole thing conclude.
Right.
With the troubling problem of the death of the wicked. Because that's been the cornerstone of trouble for us to really be able to trust God. And I know in my own conversion experience, I had to settle that initially. And within 2 weeks of my conversion experience, and I thought, if John is right that God is love, he cannot destroy the wicked at the end. That is not an act of love. It has to be natural consequence. And then I told myself, well, I'd never find that in the Bible. And I know I wouldn't find it in Ellen White. I was reading Desire of Ages at the time, and I came to the chapter, It Is Finished. And I came to her wording, which is very biblical, but very troubling. At the end of the page, 763, I think it is. And I took a deep breath, turned over the page, and there it was. This is not an act of arbitrary power on the part of God. Sinners reap that which they have sown. By a life of rebellion, Satan and all who join with him, and I can't remember how the rest of it goes, but you probably read that statement. And I was so excited. I was sitting cross-legged on my bed for my morning worship. I leaped into the air and said, it's true, it's true, it's really true. But that had to be settled for me to be able to fully trust God.
And you know, there's nothing wrong with thirst. We are created to be thirsty. We're created to be hungry. Otherwise, you wouldn't enjoy food and water.
That's true.
It's not a bad thing to be thirsty. It's a bad thing to never be able to drink.
Yes.
It's actually... I like to feel hungry sometimes because then food tastes so much better. And the more thirsty you are, the better the water tastes. So, you know, it's a healthy thing that, it can be abused, obviously, but that doesn't make the original unhealthy.
Could we, based on this text, suggest that the wicked are those who were thought thirsty?
I think that needs to be unpacked because Jesus talks about that in the Gospels. You know, when he was at the temple, he said, he who is thirsty, come to me and I will give you living water. Mm-hmm. Almost a direct quote here. And yeah, Ellen White has some interesting things to say about that because she said, in all the symbolism of the priest pouring out the water and all the drama and everything, you know, the fantastic effects and sights and sounds and smells. And yet amid all this formality, there was this deep emptiness in people's hearts that was palpable. And she said that when Jesus suddenly cries out, he was literally addressing that palpable feeling of emptiness, mm-hmm. that all of this formality is just not satisfying. And it really resonated with the people who were honest.
So you could say that the people who are on the sea of glass in this chapter are those who are thirsty.
Yeah. And they're willing to receive.
And that would, one of the aspects of spiritual thirst is the raising of questions.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I have put a very high premium on in my classes. I require a question of every assignment. And if they fail to put one on, they are docked 4 points out of 20. I don't always take it out on them. I allow them to redo it so that they learn to do it. So I'm not punitive about it, but I want them to know it's important because I believe that questions are the bedrock of understanding and learning.
Yes. Without a question, your mind is not in a posture to receive anything.
It's exactly right. And unfortunately, education in our society has minimized questions and made them not capable of being asked. In fact, generations of students have made fun of their classmates for raising questions.
Yeah.
I found your quote from The Desire of Ages.
764.
Yes, 763 into 764. This is not an arbitrary, sorry, this is not an act of arbitrary power on the part of God. The rejectors of his mercy reap that which they have sown. God is the fountain of life. And when one chooses the service of sin, he separates from God and thus cuts himself off from life. He is, quotes, alienated from the life of God, end quotes, Christ says. And they that hate me love death, Ephesians 4:18 and Proverbs 8:36. God gives them existence for a time.
So that's another metaphor we can add to the water of life.
Oh. Wisdom?
No.
Or hate?
No. Another, they love death if they don't thirst. They
yes.
love life if they're thirsty.
Correct. If you're thirsty, you drink. Otherwise, you love death.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. I'm with you on that. God gives them existence for a time that they may develop their character and reveal their principles. This accomplished, they receive the results of their own choice. By a life of rebellion, Satan and all who unite with him place themselves so out of harmony with God that his very presence is to them a consuming fire. The glory of him who is love will destroy them.
That whole chapter has had a lot of meaning for me.
It's and, rich. Yeah, go ahead.
It is rich with things. And I remember deciding one day I was going to read that chapter and I was going to take notes and I was going to stop. I only read as fast as I could understand every part of it. Because there were things in there that puzzled me that seemed forensic. By the time I got through writing, because I carried what was said in the first few paragraphs on 759 all the way through, I was able to see that she was not heralding the forensic model. She was opposing it.
Right. Oh, just like Paul. But yes, I agree.
Though there's a whole commentary on that chapter somewhere on the website, eugeneag.org, because I took my students through it. That's the first thing we did when we started recording.
Well, there's that statement, because every now and then, if I just drop into it, I'm like, ah! So I have to read the context. But Satan said every infraction must...
Every sin must be punished.
That's it. Satan urged, yes.
Urged, yes.
And that he also asserts through her pen here that mercy breaks justice. And God was saying, no.
But her seminal statement is on 759. I wish I had my copy here. My brain isn't letting me remember what that statement says.
Well, it starts at 758.
It's in the middle of 759.
759.
While you're looking, or did you find it, Bill?
Well, I'm seeing there's five paragraphs.
I was just going to comment on the first quote there. Why wouldn't that make sense if Jesus says, I am the way, I'm the truth, and I am the life, by the way? So if you're not united with the person who's the life giver, where does that leave you? Kind of disconnected from the respirator or life giver?
Yeah.
I'm thinking you're dead.
So, Gene, let me read you two paragraphs. God could have this disturbs me, but okay. God could have destroyed Satan and his sympathizers as easily as one can cast a pebble to earth.
Sure. That's the one I'm talking about.
Okay. I do have an issue with that, but she brings it around. So, but he did not do this. Rebellion was not to be overcome by force. Compelling power is found only under Satan's government.
Exactly.
The Lord's principles are not of this order. His authority rests upon goodness, mercy, and love, and the presentation of these principles is the means to be used. God's government is moral, and truth and love are to be the prevailing power. It was God's purpose to place things on an eternal basis of security, and in the councils of heaven, it was decided that time must be given for Satan to develop the principles which were the foundation of his system of government. He had claimed that these principles were superior to God's. Time was given for the working of Satan's principles that they might be seen by the heavenly universe.
You notice that she doesn't itemize what those principles are, the counterfeit ones.
She does in another place.
Well, she did earlier, because God's ways are not going to be through power and force and coercion.
Yeah. Okay, that's part of it.
The principle, the main principle she's after is force.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Freedom is love, force is of the devil, of evil. Yep.
And I get the literal, like literary. Literal. So the literary approach she's taking. I just have to say, though, I keep coming back, and I will push back against the thought that God could have squashed him.
That's rhetorical.
He cannot be contrary to his character.
Of course not. She's not addressing that issue.
I know. And that's where she comes around to that. But it just always, I hear that, and it's like, it always makes me recoil.
But she's preempting the question,
yes,
or the doubt that he had the power to do it.
Right.
Because some people would say, well, if he didn't do it, then he must not be able to do it. He's like, no, he's quite able to do it, but that's not what he's like.
Yeah, I get all the arguments. I just, every time I see it, it just is a, I've got issues with the language. Anyway, it's fine. I know it's a rhetorical device that she's using.
Well, right. He could have, but then what does it accomplish? It plays in the enemy's hands, and now he's become the very thing that he said he wasn't.
Yeah.
And that Lucifer has accused him of being.
And then the rebel wins.
Right, you got it. So what's the point of playing it out if it's not gonna let sin play its hand? Sin's got to demonstrate that sin kills us, and Jesus comes and helps us by taking it on, showing you, let me show you, I'm not going to ask you, my creatures, to prove the truthfulness of what I'm saying. I will demonstrate it.
Yeah.
And then, not only that, he's not going to do anything that's power over, ever. In fact, he lays his life down willingly. It's so paradoxical. How many people win a war by losing their life? We don't.
Right? But God is life in that sense. So God, and there's a sense in which, because who raised Jesus, his own divine spark on it seems. So, but in laying his life, the incarnation, not just his death, the whole of the incarnation is this example that sets in complete contrast the way the adversary works and the way God works.
Right. My ways are not your ways.
And so it's not just death. It's the entirety of the whole concept of incarnation.
Well, and his whole character, like you said, he's not gonna. And some people think he was born with a divine character. I say no.
Oh, well, yeah, that's a whole other subject. But yes, what was his humanity? Anyway, so this, the Alpha and the Omega is where we started, I think, with this.
I think it really, yeah, the Alpha, well, the beginning and the end, to me, highlights God's Christ, which Christ is the one who rescues God's reputation. He takes on the role of saving God's reputation from the very outset of when it began to be questioned.
In the universe.
That's the beginning, way before this earth. And he's the end. So he is going to see the fight over God's reputation all the way through until it's won. He's not going to stop until it's finished.
Could I interject something? The reason he has to take it on is because he's the one who is, you might say, the victim. Satan's defection and his rebellion was because he wasn't allowed, like Jesus, to be on the committee to decide what to do with this planet.
Right.
Which, interestingly, sounds a bit like control, doesn't it?
And it seems to be that in the great controversy, whoever is the one pointed at as being out of line, or this is not fair, or whatever, whoever's the victim has to be the one to take over. And they do it not by power, but by allowing themselves to die. In the case of Jesus, that's the way it's done.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's revelatory on like levels of onion, you know, layers of onion, I guess. Yeah. You peel off one layer and you discover a whole nother one sitting there that's like, wow.
And you cry your way through it.
Well, see, I see Jesus as the one who Satan was really against, because they were both Lucifer. They were both the bearers of light.
Yeah.
And because Jesus was on the council to decide about creating us human beings, and Satan wasn't, he had nothing to contribute. He wasn't, because he was a created being, something he did not want to accept. Therefore, Jesus had to be the one to answer the questions. So it's not arbitrary, and it's not simply Jesus taking over to do something the Father couldn't do. Mm-hmm. It's something that's part of the blueprint. I would like to spend a little bit of time on verse 8. Well, maybe we should do verse 7 first. Those who conquer will inherit these things, and I will be their God, and they will be my people, my children. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the polluted, the murderers, the fornicators, the sorcerers, the idolaters, and all the liars, their place will be in the lake of fire that burns with the fire and sulfur, which is the second death. It doesn't say God's going to throw them into. That's their place. That's where they go.
Which is what Jesus said. It was prepared for the devil and his angels. So they have so aligned themselves with the view of God that the devil and the angels have promoted. Mm-hmm. They've entirely aligned themselves. So their part is what was prepared. And how was it prepared? Well, the brimstone is, like we said last time, a symbol of flashes of divinity. And I think in that day, brimstone or sulfur was the hottest and brightest possible fire you could create in that day. And so they're saying, the extreme brightness and the extreme heat of whatever divinity is what causes, what composes the lake of fire, which is God's presence.
And it's, I think it always, it seems to me, is essential to say, and it's what gives life to those
yes.
who abide.
Yes.
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 So if you're resistant to love, you will experience it as nothing but torment. When you are not resistant to love, you experience it as super energizing life, which yes. is in Daniel, they will shine as the stars of the firmament. Stars are suns full of fire.
Mm-hmm.
And so we will ignite with the very fire of God in ecstasy, while the lost who are resisting love are igniting with torment and torture. And in the parable of the debtor, he's like, he released him to the torturers mm-hmm. until the debt was paid. And the only way the only debt that existed was him not forgiving his fellow servant, because his debt was paid. It was forgiven, and it was never unforgiven. The only debt left that had to be paid was the one he was collecting on, which is illegitimate to start with. And he says, you will be with the torturers until every penny of that debt is paid. And the only way it could be paid is for him to forgive it.
Right. It's about releasing it.
Yes.
Back out.
So if you never release it, then you stay in the lake of fire and torment. If you forgive, then it turns into ecstasy instead of torment.
Well, it's over at that point.
I must confess, Floyd, that this reminds me of Satan at the end of the millennium when everybody turns on him.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
You pointed to this as possibly portraying Satan. Not maybe this passage, but an earlier one.
The second lake of fire mentioned.
Second lake of fire.
In the middle of 19.
Anyway, it just, because he will be turned it over to the torturers. I mean, that's yes. the only place he can go.
Yes, and the torturers are everybody he has deceived.
Mm-hmm.
And to him who craves admiration and worship as his ultimate goal, and to have everybody who gave him the worship withdraw it and give him nothing but hatred is the ultimate torment.
Think about, yeah, the malignant narcissist who gets none of what they crave.
Yes, yes.
Interesting.
They become probably very dangerous.
No, I agree. In fact, I was just thinking about truth and love being the fire.
Yeah.
Because what is it that Satan has that Satan does not have that Jesus does? Satan has no truth in him. He's father of all lies. He's not about love. He's about a killer from the beginning, a murderer from the beginning. Just the opposite. So anybody in harmony or out of harmony with truth and love, they're going to be consumed, as I see it.
But here it doesn't even say consumed. It just says their part is in the lake.
Mm-hmm.
Common English says consume them. In verse 9, destroy them.
Well, it does say this is the second death.
Yeah. Are we talking about verse 9? Yeah.
Well, verse 9 goes on to something completely different.
Yeah.
Their chosen place or their lot is in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, and this is the second death.
Yeah, the chosen place is interestingly worded.
What verse?
That was verse 8. You know, it's interesting, at least in the way Jonathan has Free Bible Version, anyone who is a coward, I don't know how that reads in others. So it seems like the courageous have wrestled with their cowardice and their other things. I'm trying to picture the hero's journey of union with God and not being a coward in that.
When you have an abuser, you either enable that abuser or you are abused. Those who are abused are the courageous ones.
Okay.
The cowards are those who enable the abuser. It's a little bit counterintuitive, but I think that's how it works.
Well, because they stand up to the bully and they will get abused by the bully into submission. I mean, that was also part of the revelation in the incarnation, is Jesus was not a bully, but
He stood up to the bully,
and we see the natural bend.
He was crucified because of it.
Well, I would like to kind of go through, I'm just saying this to remind myself, the bride, because maybe that's a natural place, because 9 leads us into the Lamb's wife,
yeah,
the bride. And the chapter starts with, prepared, the New Jerusalem comes prepared like a bride.
Yeah, I think that's a new chapter for a new
a new week.
New week. Yeah. When we get through Revelation, we've got to decide what we're going to do next.
Okay.
And one of the ways we could do it is to redo Revelation, read it again, like Tonstad suggests.
Yeah.
And read it less analytically and more as a story.
Mm-hmm. That's an idea.
Overview.
Mm-hmm. Because once you've hashed out and radically challenged so many of the symbols and meanings and assumptions, and then you go back and read it with that library of revised words, all of a sudden, yeah, even the beginning looks different then.
Okay, so let's have closing prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for the journey you have led us on today. It's been fruitful. We pray that you will keep this journey in our minds and that you will help us in the future to be able to reread Revelation in such a way as we really grasp who you are in that journey and how you operate in your universe. May we not lose sight at any point that you have won the war, not by conquest and not by fear, not by torture, not by anger, but you have won it by love. We thank you for this. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.